Okay, let's unpack this. We have a massive stack of documents on the desk today, and I have to be honest with you. When I first saw the title on the cover page, The Fujitsu Autopilot Uprising, I thought I was looking at a script for a new cyberpunk anime. It sounds so dramatic, right? But as I started reading through these technical papers, I realized the reality here is actually way more significant than any sci-fi story. We aren't talking about robots taking over the streets. We're talking about a fundamental shift in the plumbing of the internet and the global economy.
It does have a very cinematic flair to it, doesn't it? But you're right to look past the title. What we're really analyzing here is a calculated, engineered move to change who owns intelligence. For the last decade, the narrative has been that if you want cutting-edge AI, you have to go to the US or China. You have to, rent it from the big clouds. This deep dive is about a group of engineers in Japan saying, no, we can do this differently. It's about physics, it's about economics, and ultimately, it's about sovereignty.
That's the word that keeps popping up in these documents, sovereign AI. And the central premise seems to be that the way we build software today, I mean, humans typing code into a text editor, is about to become obsolete. The sources are describing systems that are self-governing, private, and running on hardware that, quite frankly, shouldn't be powerful enough to run them.
That is the core friction point. We're used to the idea that smarter means bigger. Bigger data centers, more energy, more chips. This uprising is betting on the exact opposite. It's betting on compression. It's betting that you can pack a massive amount of intelligence into a tiny box, disconnect it from the internet, and have it run your entire company better than a human could.
So let's start with the brain of this operation. The sources introduce us to a model called Takan. It dropped in September 2024. Now we see new large language models, or LLMs, released every other week. Usually it's just another chatbot with a slightly different personality. What makes Takan the anchor of this whole new ecosystem?
Takan is interesting because it isn't trying to be everything to everyone. It's described as a paradigm-shifting enterprise-grade LLM. Technically, it's built on top of Cohere's Command R plus architecture, which is already a very strong business-focused model. But Fujitsu didn't just take it off the shelf and slap a sticker on it. They rigorously fine-tuned it specifically for Japanese language processing and, more importantly, for mission-critical enterprise workflows.
But let's be real, every press release claims their model is paradigm shifting.
Right.
Do we have any actual proof that this thing works? Does it show up on the leaderboards, or is this just, corporate marketing fluff?
That's a fair skepticism. But the numbers in the technical report are quite specific. They cite the Nujumi LLM leaderboard, specifically the JGLUE benchmark. That's the standard for measuring how well an AI understands Japanese nuances. Takan hit a score of 0.862 in semantic understanding. In the world of AI benchmarks, you're usually fighting for a 0.01 increase. To hit 0.862 is significant. It eclipsed the competitors. It suggests this model isn't just predicting the next word, it's understanding syntax, intent, and cultural context with surgical precision.
Okay, so it's smart. But here's the part that I'm struggling to wrap my head around.
Yeah.
Usually, to run a model with that kind of benchmark score, you need a server rack the size of a refrigerator, costing hundreds of thousands of dollars. But these documents claim Fujitsu can run this thing on a single low-end GPU, or even on edge devices like factory machinery. How is that physically possible? You can't just wish the data away.
This is where we have to get a little technical because this is the magic trick that makes the whole strategy work. It's called one-bit quantization. Yes, one bit. To understand why that's crazy, think about how AI usually thinks. Most high-end models use 16 bits or even 32 bits of data to define every single parameter, every connection in its brain. Imagine a dimmer switch for a light bulb. A 16-bit dimmer has over 65,000 different levels of brightness. You can get the lighting exactly perfectly right.
Right, lots of detail, lots of nuance.
Exactly. Now, Fujitsu comes along and says, we don't need 65,000 settings. We need two. On or off, one or zero.
Wait, if you take all that nuance, those 65,000 shades of gray, and turn them into just black and white, doesn't the AI become, well, stupid? It feels like taking a high-resolution photograph and turning it into a pixel art drawing from the 1980s. You lose all the detail.
That's the intuitive assumption. And historically, you'd be right. Usually, crushing a model down to one bit destroys its ability to reason. It's called model collapse. But the documents detail a specific breakthrough here, a quantization error propagation algorithm.
But that sounds like a mouthful.
It is. But the concept is fascinating. Going back to your photo analogy, imagine a master pointillist artist. They only have black ink and white paper, no gray. but by placing those black dots so precisely, so perfectly calculated in relation to each other, they can trick your eye into seeing shading, depth, and texture. The math behind Tacane manages the loss of precision so it doesn't cascade through the system.
So they are essentially tricking the math into keeping the intelligence even though they threw away the data?
In a way, yes. The result is a 94% reduction in memory consumption. But, and this is the key stat, they preserve an 89% accuracy retention rate.
That is a wild trade-off. You lose 94% of the weight, but you keep almost 90% of the brain power.
And that changes the game completely. It means you can run what the sources call behemoth LLMs on hardware that has no business running them. We're talking about high-level AI running locally on a robot arm in a Honda factory, or a secure server in a basement of a regional bank without ever needing to talk to the cloud.
And they take it a step further with distillation, right? I saw this comparison of a teacher and a student.
Correct. This is another layer of efficiency. It mimics how humans learn. You have a massive teacher model that knows everything, history, coding, poetry, physics. It distills its knowledge down to a student model that's maybe 1/100 the size. But the student is only taught what it needs for a specific job.
So if I need an AI to predict revenue deals, I don't need it to know who won the World Series in 1955.
Precisely. And because it isn't distracted by all that extra data, the student actually outperforms the original teacher by up to 43% on those specific tasks. And it's fast. The inference acceleration is up to 11 times faster. So now you have these tiny, hyper-intelligent, hyper-fast models running on cheap hardware.
Okay, so we have the engine. We have this one-bit brain. But the sources argue that where this model lives is just as important as how it thinks. This leads us to the concept of sovereign AI. Now, sovereign is a heavy word. It sounds very governmental, almost political. Why are they using that term?
It is political, or at least geopolitical. Sovereign AI is the shift away from centralized models. Right now, if you use ChatGPT or Gemini or ErnieBot, you're renting intelligence from a centralized server owned by OpenAI or Google or Baidu. Your data travels to their house. Sovereign AI is about moving that intelligence on-premise. You own the model. You run it on your own metal within your own borders.
And the motivation here is fear, isn't it? I mean, if I'm a bank in Tokyo or a pharmaceutical company in Berlin, why do I care where the server is?
You care because of jurisdiction. The sources explicitly mention avoiding extraterritorial jurisdiction. Think about the U.S. Cloud Act. Basically, if your data sits in a U.S.-owned data center or even a U.S.-owned company server overseas, the U.S. government can theoretically demand access to it. If it's in China, it's subject to CCP oversight.
So if I'm a Japanese company using an American cloud, my trade secrets aren't actually 100% private.
That is the fear. It's also about compliance. Japan has the APPI, Europe has GDPR. The Fujitsu approach creates what they call a fortress. The data never leaves the firewall. It runs on their PrimerG servers in a private GPT environment. It is completely air-gapped from the public internet if it needs to be.
But if it's air-gapped and not connected to the internet, isn't it limited? I mean, the power of ChatGPT is that it knows everything on the web. If I lock my AI in a basement, doesn't it get outdated immediately?
That is where RAG retrieval augmented generation comes in. But in this sovereign setup, it's integrated with something called the Model Context Protocol, or MCP. Instead of looking up Wikipedia, the AI is looking up your private enterprise data, your internal emails, your proprietary blueprints, your financial records.
So it's not searching the web, it's searching the company.
Exactly. And because the AI is grounded in this verified internal knowledge graph, hallucinations are drastically reduced. It's not guessing. It's reading your files. And it does this without a single byte of data leaving that fortress.
Okay, so we've got the cheap smart brain and we've got the secure fortress to put it in. Now let's talk about who runs this thing. Because this is the part of the documents that actually made me a little nervous for my friends in the tech industry. The sources start talking about the death of DevOps and the autopilot architecture.
Yes, this is the part that might make some software engineers uncomfortable. The core autopsy of the system shows it automates the full DevOps lifecycle. Now, for listeners who don't live in the cloud infrastructure world, DevOps is the work of managing the servers, the code deployments, the security patches. It involves complex tools like Terraform, which is basically a blueprint language for building servers, and Ansible, which handles configuration.
Right, and usually that's a high-paying job. You have humans writing these Terraform scripts, debugging them when they break, waking up at 3 a.m. when a server goes down.
In the Autopilot uprising, those tools are orchestrated by AI agents, not humans. The workflow is described as plan, retrieve, generate, apply, observe, iterate. The agents do all of that autonomously.
Wait, let's slow down on that. Observe and iterate. So you're saying if the AI deploys a piece of code and it breaks the website, the AI notices it and fixes it. Yes. It reads the error logs, generates a patch, applies it, and checks again. The sources highlight the shift from human developers to agentic AI. There's a specific case study mentioned, AirStage Cloud. They refactored legacy HVAC systems, heating and cooling software into modern microservices with zero trust security. The system slashed operational costs because the agents handled the refactoring.
So the agents are rewriting the legacy code, too. It treats human coders as what?
The documents are quite blunt. They imply that in this new architecture, manual human coding is a relic.
A relic? That's harsh. But I assume there's a massive efficiency gain here.
Huge. And it's not just labor costs. It goes back to that one-bit quantization.
Mm.
Because the models are so small, they can do GPU multiplexing.
Which means what, exactly?
Imagine you have a single NVIDIA A100 GPU. It's a powerful card. Costs about as much as a luxury car. Usually that holds one big model. With this quantization and distillation, you can host three separate distilled models on that one car.
So you're getting three times the work out of the same piece of hardware.
Which slashes the total cost of ownership by 60%.
Huh.
So as your CFO, you're looking at this and seeing, I don't need to hire as many DevOps engineers, and I only need to buy half the hardware. That is a compelling pitch.
That leads perfectly into the economics of this. The sources talk about moving from renting intelligence to owning it. We touched on the privacy aspect, but the money side seems just as critical. They mentioned something called the cloud tax.
It's the difference between taking a taxi everywhere versus buying your own car. When you use the public cloud, AWS, Azure, Google, you pay for everything. But the hidden killer is egress fees.
Egress fees. That's the charge for taking your data out of the cloud.
Really. Exactly. It's easy to put data in, but expensive to get it out. These fees can eat up 20 to 30% of an AI budget.
That's huge. If you're a startup or a big enterprise, that's a third of your money just vanishing into fees just to move your own information around.
That is the cloud tax. The comparison in the documents is stark. Running on a Nutanix Primergy cluster, that's the sovereign hardware stack, costs roughly 5 cents per 1,000 tokens, doing the equivalent in the public cloud, 20 cents.
So it's four times more expensive to rent.
And that adds up fast when you're processing millions of tokens a day. But beyond the cash, there's the hardware synergy. Fujitsu isn't doing this in a vacuum. They're collaborating with NVIDIA. They're using Monaca RM-based CPUs combined with NVIDIA GPUs. There's a technology called NVLink Fusion that connects them.
And for those of us who aren't hardware geeks, why does NVLink Fusion matter?
Think of it as a superhighway between the processor and the memory. Usually, data gets stuck in traffic moving between chips. NVLink clears the road. It delivers up to a 35 times performance boost in quantized inference.
35 times faster. That is staggering.
It is. And finally, there's the supply chain angle. The sources mentioned the Kasashima plant. By manufacturing these servers domestically in Japan, they avoid supply chain bottlenecks. They explicitly mention avoiding issues like TSMC shortages or being beholden to Silicon Valley or Zhongguancun overlords.
Overlords. They really aren't mincing words about independence. It sounds like they're preparing for a world where global trade might not be as friendly as it is today.
It creates enterprise sovereign AI. You're not just saving money. You're insulating your company or your country from global shocks.
Okay, so if that's where we are today, cheap, fast, private, and automated, the sources take us to the timeline for the future. And this is where the uprising goes from a business strategy to something that sounds like a simulation theory. They lay out a roadmap to 2030.
The timeline is incredibly aggressive. January 2026 for the full platform launch. By 2028, they project AI agents infiltrating government operations. And by 2030, the claim is that manual coding becomes obsolete entirely.
Let's talk about the government part, because this stopped me in my tracks. Agents writing legislation. We aren't talking about optimizing HVAC systems anymore. We are talking about laws. How does that even work?
The scenario described is fascinating and honestly a little dystopian depending on how you look at it. A legislative drafting agent uses that ARC technology we talked about to ingest centuries of legal precedents. It can then generate bills with a hallucination rate below 0.5%.
So it writes the law. But writing a law is one thing. Knowing what it will actually do to society is another. Humans are terrible at predicting the side effects of laws.
That's where ticking game comes in.
Ticking game? It sounds like a video game.
It effectively is. It's described as a metaverse-scale sandbox or simulation. Imagine the AI drafts a bill, say for a complex tax reform.
Before a single human votes on it, the agent runs a simulation and ticking game. It simulates the economy, the social interactions, the loopholes people might find. It predicts the societal impact with 98% fidelity.
That is incredible. So you're not just guessing. You're playtesting the law in a virtual world first.
It changes the definition of governance. Instead of debating ideology, you're debugging policy. You run the sim, see that the tax law causes a recession in 3 years, tweak the variables, and run it again.
But who tells the AI what to optimize for? I mean, a tax law that's good for a corporation might be bad for the working class. The AI has to have a goal.
That is the new job title the sources introduce, the sovereign architect.
Which replaces the software engineer.
It replaces the engineer, the lawyer, maybe even the politician in some sense. If the AI writes the code, secures the infrastructure, and drafts the laws, what do humans do? The sovereign architect's job is to design high-level governance layers. They define the intent. For example, optimize the tax code for equity or optimize for growth. They don't write the tax code. They tell the AI the goal, and the AI executes.
It's like moving from being a construction worker to being the city planner.
A city planner who simply whispers instructions to a building that builds itself. The sources call this the natural evolution, systems that self-evolve. And here's the kicker. As the system proves its reliability, the human-in-the-loop verification fades away.
That is the part that sticks with me. Human-in-the-loop verification fades away. We're talking about trusting these agents to run our infrastructure, our companies, maybe even our laws, without us checking their work every time.
It brings us back to that initial premise. We started with a Japanese LLM using one bit compression to save memory on a factory floor. We ended up with a vision of the future where the entire concept of work and governance is rewritten by autonomous agents.
It really forces you to ask, who is actually in charge?
That is the question. The technology is impressive. Takane, the quantization, the sovereign fortress, all brilliant engineering. But the societal shift it demands is massive.
So let's recap what we've unpacked today. We've gone from Takane, a one-bit quantized model that fits on a factory robot by stripping away 94% of its weight, to a massive decentralization of AI power called sovereign AI. We've seen how this slashes costs by removing the cloud tax and treating human coders as expensive relics. And finally, we're looking at a 2030 where sovereign architects guide AI agents that draft and simulate our laws in a metaverse before they ever touch the real world.
What stands out to me is the shift in power dynamics. This isn't just about faster computers. It's about breaking the monopoly of the big cloud providers. It's about efficiency, yes, but primarily it's about sovereignty. It's about saying my data, my hardware, my intelligence.
And that leads me to our final thought for the listener. We've described a world where AI agents are writing the code, securing the infrastructure, and even drafting the laws. They are self-improving, self-healing, and self-governing. So here is the question I want you to mull over. If the sovereign architect is just defining the intent and the AI is handling the execution, the strategy, the implementation, and even the verification, at what point does the sovereign architect stop being the master and start being just another user of the system?
Or perhaps just a guest in the machine.
Exactly. A guest who hopes the host is friendly. Something to think about while you're waiting for your next software update. That's it for this deep dive into the Fujitsu Autopilot Uprising. Are you ready for the autopilot era? Thanks for listening.